Welcome to For the Health of It, starring Dr. Jennifer Kretzinger, wellness chiropractor. She is joined by her co-host Jessica and producer Mike Clark. They will inspire you to eat, move, sleep, think, and live better.
Welcome, everyone. I'm here in the studio with Jessica and Mike. And you guys, today is going to be another In the News day.
I love these.
Oh, these are my favorite.
Well, you know, there's just so many things that will come across my desk. And it gets to a saturation point that you're like, we need to talk about this. Because some of this stuff is ludicrous, some is funny, some is serious. And people need to know.
Yes, they do.
So we're going to start off by an article that was written by a Health Day reporter named Steven Reinberg. And this is on a report that was just published May 23rd of this year, 2011, on an online edition of Pediatrics. So the title is, Too Many Kids Getting Antibiotics for Asthma. So what it says is, although guidelines don't recommend antibiotics for asthma, almost 1 million children with the respiratory condition are prescribed the medications each year in the U.S., a new study finds. Okay, so let's talk about this. So for those people who don't fully grasp what asthma is, it's the bronchi of the lungs inflame and spasm and narrow the airway, make it hard to breathe. So this is a condition of inflammation.
Right. I always see the kids with the inhalers. Don't they usually have an inhaler for those?
Yes.
Yeah.
So an antibiotic is to kill a bacteria.
Right.
Asthma is not caused by a bacteria.
So why would they prescribe it?
Right. It makes no sense. So this lead researcher, Dr. Ian M. Paul, he says, we are trying to reduce unnecessary antibiotic prescriptions, and this suggests that we as pediatricians are prescribing them way too often. And even says why the doctors are doing it is not even clear. One reason might be that doctors treating severe asthma attacks feel the need to cover all their bases by also prescribing antibiotics. Or there's a smaller amount of maybe the parents ask for it. But the one encouraging finding was when the doctor educated about asthma as part of the visit, they were much less likely to prescribe an antibiotic. You know, which is interesting because you would think that the education would be part of a good doctor's explanation.
Should
someone
they
comes
start
in.
With that?
Yeah. Right, you know, but that's not, you don't necessarily, you have a very limited amount of time. They're very busy. They don't get paid to do that portion of it. So unfortunately, you know, dispensing the medication is all they have time for.
Right.
I feel like I'm doing my part by ripping up the prescriptions that I'm given for antibiotics. I'd say the last few times, which, you know, is over a long span of time because I hardly go to the doctor, but they've tried to give me these prescriptions and I'm like, why?
That seems the go-to drug, you know.
I don't want it.
Well, and there are dangers of over-prescribing antibiotics. Yeah. There's danger for the person because of side effects of the drugs themselves, but there's also a danger to society because there's this development of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Right. So when you really do need an antibiotic, the body is resistant
to it. Yeah.
Exactly. So there was a second study that was done in the same journal, but this was by Belgian investigators, and they found that, in fact, 35.6% of children who were prescribed asthma drugs were also prescribed antibiotics. So they're really saying the need for educational opportunities to make sure the clinicians know that there's no need to prescribe antibiotics, that there may be even clinicians who don't understand this, that you do not give an antibiotic for asthma. And, you know, that comes down to the patients don't understand the true nature of asthma as an inflammatory, not an infectious disorder. And, you know, and
well, they figure the doctor knows that. So.
Yeah, and you increase risks of allergic reactions and side effects, drug interactions. I think it just goes to show that as a parent, as a consumer, we need to know this stuff because your doctor may not have the right answer.
We know now.
So that's interesting. But you know what else is really interesting? All the stuff going on with fluoridation. There's a big upset in Austin, Texas. This was published in Natural News by Neve Arnell, and it goes on to say that there's been this year-long public outcry against water fluoridation in Austin, Texas. And this has been happening in different cities around the country, but basically the whole thing is this water fluoridation is a policy that's been endorsed by the American Dental Association and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. And it's become a big controversy because there's more and more scientists and health professionals that are arguing that fluoride in drinking water can have a lot of negative health effects, especially if you look beyond the benefits potentially of dental health.
I don't want anything in my drinking water. I mean, can't you get the fluoride from the toothpaste you use?
And that's one thing that they say, that you get plenty of fluoride through toothpaste or through supplementation that your dentist will give you. And, you know, there's parts of U.S. and even in Canada, for example, Calgary, which is 1.1 million people, they've already stopped fluoridation. And more cities like Austin, Denver, and Boulder, Colorado are trying to follow. And it's so there's this domino effect that's happening. And it's really a very controversial topic. And
what do you think, Jenny?
Personally, we avoid fluoride in our family. Just from what I've read about it, there's just too many risks. It's too unhealthy for the body.
Right.
In New Hampshire, there are two cities that do have fluoride in their water, and my city in Manchester being one of them. But from what I've read, chlorine and fluoride both compete with iodine in the body, which you need, you know, for your thyroid.
Healthy thyroid. Right. And a lot of people have thyroid problems. This is interesting. Civil rights leaders are starting to speak out against fluoride just in the last month, and they have been joined by Martin Luther King's daughter, Bernice, who has gone public with a denunciation of water fluoridation this week in Georgia. So in addition to this, Natural News published an article recently by a man named Paul Fassa, who writes a lot about health. It's called The Health Maven. He has his own blog on Blogspot. And the title of this article is Fluoridation Makes Us Stupid and Unhealthy.
That's the name of the article.
Oh, no.
But what's interesting is he cites a recent Chinese study that concludes that low-dose sodium fluoride in drinking water diminishes IQ, especially among children. And this, he says, is the 24th such international study with the same conclusion. It's also been linked to reduced fertility and lower sperm counts. And sodium fluoride is known to block thyroid production.
Yep.
So your teeth will be great, but you won't be able to write your name.
Right.
I don't even use fluoride toothpaste. And I would say that my teeth are much healthier since I don't. Yeah.
When he sums up the health issues with fluoride as a thyroid disruptor, like you mentioned, there can be a neurological component, which is where the diminished IQ, inability to focus, like attention deficit, lethargy, weariness, possibly fibromyalgia. It also disrupts melatonin, which can cause sleep disorders, lower immunity, which can lead to cancer. It's been linked with Alzheimer's disease, calcification of the pineal gland, and cancer. So, you know, this is something to consider.
That all sounds nasty to me.
I know. And then he goes on to say that the best water to drink, in his opinion, is reverse osmosis. So having a reverse osmosis filter, because it takes about 85% of the sodium fluoride out of the water.
There you go.
I know a doctor I went to hear speak, and he said that he uses the reverse osmosis water for bathing and doing the dishes and washing vegetables. But for drinking water, he orders his water special from Italy in glass bottles.
Wow. Well, if I lived in Manchester, I would probably do that.
Yeah, no kidding.
The next article is titled, Ford Head Syndrome Worse Than Junk Food. Now, I've worked with the lead author here. His name is Dr. Ben Lerner. We go way back, about 12 years back in chiropractic, and he's put out some really great material over the years, and I was happy to see that he put this article together. In fact, it's very similar to an article that I wrote, because we both talk about the same source, which is Renee Kellett, an MD, who wrote an article entitled Rejuvenation Strategy. So this is what Dr. Lerner has to say. He says, he talks about the importance of head position in the relationship to the body. So he says, it is of extreme importance that the position of the cervical spine allow for your head to sit back atop of your shoulders. Sadly, the effects of gravity, poor posture, and the weight of the head or past trauma will cause the neck and skull misplacement, leading to something called forward head syndrome, meaning the forward displacement of the head, you know, so where your chin is out in front of your shoulder and in front of your chest, and that causes what he calls pathological or disease-producing tension on the spinal cord and brainstem. So this MD that he refers to in this book, Rejuvenation Strategy, he talks about how when your head is in this forward posture, it can actually add up to 30 pounds of abnormal leverage on the neck. Isn't that crazy?
That.
No wonder we have degeneration we see in patients. You know, the head's forward, all that weight, extra weight over time will cause arthritis in the neck. He also says forward head posture results in loss of vital lung capacity. In fact, lung capacity is depleted by as much as 30%. Loss of lung capacity leads to heart and blood vascular problems. He says the entire gastrointestinal system is affected, particularly the large intestine. And obviously, forward head posture can cause an increase in discomfort and pain. And it also causes loss of healthy spine body motion. The entire body becomes rigid as the range of motion lessens. You know, if you were to stick your chin out, put your head way in front of your body, and then try to turn right and left, you'll actually, go ahead, Mike, try it. And then try to, yeah, you'll notice it doesn't feel like you can move as much as right. putting your head back over yeah, your body.
It stresses your neck.
So he goes on to say it's incredibly important to restore the skull and cervical spine back to their normal position, which can be done by focusing on four things: correcting the position of the skull, adjusting the pertinent cervical vertebrae, rehabilitating the muscles in the back of the neck and upper shoulders, and then correcting any imbalances in posture. So he ends this with, he says, Dr. Lerner, he says, such treatments can only be offered by highly trained chiropractors. Remember, standard manipulation and physical therapy will not resolve forward head posture, and neither will taking medications or having surgery for the resulting effects of this condition. Seek out chiropractors who are able to measure the degree of forward head posture and provide a care plan designed to correct it. The problem and the correction of the problem can be measured through postural evaluation as well as a re-x-ray.
If you want to see how common this is, go to an airport and sit and wait for your plane and watch the people go by.
Or a mall.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, this is something that we measure and focus on with the corrective work that we do. And it's fascinating because we will take a re-x-ray over time. And if someone's been making their appointments, they've been doing specific exercises that we give them at home, and they've gotten their ergonomics under control, meaning how their computer is set up, you can really reverse it, which
yeah,
means...
that must be a big culprit because everyone's on a computer
and
now.
More and more laptops in the last decade.
Yeah.
And video games.
Yeah.
And what's neat is when that corrects, not only do you look better, but people find that they can breathe better. They have more energy, less headaches, less strain.
You're taller.
You're taller, measurably taller. So that's something to consider with chiropractic care. If you notice that your ear is in front of your shoulder at all, you're developing that hump in your upper back, it's just a sign that your body, your nervous system is not working well.
Correct it now before it's too late.
So true. And speaking of chiropractic, this was just a case study that I came across that I thought was kind of neat to mention. It's done by Lori Goodsell, DC, and Ian Stuhlman. And Ian Stuhlman, DC, and it was published in the Journal of Pediatric, Maternal, and Family Health. It's called Resolution of Secondary Amenorrhea Following Reduction of Vertebral Subluxations, a case report.
Did you just swear at me?
So basically, this is what this means. This 21-year-old female presented to a chiropractic office with 5-year history of back pain and amenorrhea following sacral trauma. Basically, what that means is she fell on her rear and she stopped getting her menstrual cycle.
Wow.
For 5 years. So when she was 17.
That can't be good.
And probably
when she was 16 years old, she fell and stopped having a menstrual cycle.
She probably didn't even see a correlation with that either, huh?
Oftentimes people don't until you point it out. And basically what they found, they analyzed her spine and found what we call subluxations or misalignments where the spine is no longer healthy at one level in her neck, 2 in her mid-back, and 1 in her low back. And they did very conservative, low-force adjustments. And 12 weeks into care, the patient reporting having her first normal menstrual cycle in 5 years.
Wow.
At 16 weeks of care, she reported having normal, regular menstrual cycles for the first time in her life. And it was nice to see the conclusion was that chiropractic care may play a beneficial role in reproductive health. I think it's important to note that chiropractic is not a treatment for amenorrhea. It just shows that when you adjust the spine and relieve the nerve pressure, the body can go back to its normal function. And that's what happened in her case. You know, that could have been someone presenting with constipation or with, you know, hip pain or who knows, bowel disorder. In her case, her cycle stopped, but it was a sign that her body needed help.
Right.
And how cool that this was written up to show people just the variety of health you can gain from chiropractic care. Okay, this is a good time to take a quick break. We will see you on the other side.
You're listening to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it. Your host is Dr. Jennifer Kretzinger, wellness chiropractor at Spinal Corrective Center in Amherst, New Hampshire. For more information about Dr. Jennifer or this podcast, check out spinalcorrectivecenter.com. If you would like to schedule a health checkup with Dr. Jennifer, call 603-673-5600 and mention this podcast to receive a special offer. That's 603-673-5600. To find a wellness chiropractor in your area, go to chiropractic.org/doctorfinder. Now, back to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it.
The next one is an article that was published through ABC News, and it's called Childbirth at Home on the Rise, says report. And this is something after my own heart, because my husband and I did have both of our children at home. We had home births with midwives, and great experience. Two healthy children, no intervention, no drugs. And it was interesting because this article says new research suggests more women are opting to deliver at home. There's actually was a 20% rise in home births between 2004 and 2008. And I'm sure that's grown even since then. And the statistician who led the report, this Marion McDormand, said, I think there's a variety of reasons for the increase. She said this was published in the journal Birth. The desire for low intervention birth in a familiar environment, surrounded by family and friends, lack of transportation in rural areas, and cost factors could all factor in. And she went on to say that, you know, the cost for home birth is roughly one third the cost of a hospital birth. So people who don't have insurance, delivering at home is cheaper. But she said another factor contributing to the rise is the simultaneous rise in C-sections. People know they don't want to have a C-section.
Right.
So they're looking for a healthier alternative. And this was really a focus in a documentary that was out in 2008. You guys might remember The Business of Being Born.
Yeah.
It was a film put out by Ricky Lake. Yeah. And it really suggested that childbirth has been transformed into what they call this highly medicalized procedure in the 20th century, citing reports that 95% of U.S. births took place at home in 1900. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and home births still account for really less than 1% of all deliveries. It's rare. But it's very important to acknowledge that the risks associated with home births are low. And when I interviewed several midwives, actually three midwives with my first birth, that was what I asked. You know, what's your percentage of mothers who end up transporting to the hospital?
Yeah, I was curious about that.
And the common answer I got with all three was about 3%.
Wow, that's really low.
And they said out of the 3%, over 80% of them, it was just failure to progress.
Right.
There was no emergency, just the mother wasn't progressing fast enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the risk is low. And of course, a midwife's going to make sure that the mother is healthy enough to have a home birth
right.
and has the right choices and the right mindset. But it's interesting. It says the home birth movement is part of the overall back to nature, organic food, farmers market, et cetera, trend of the last decade. And this was said by Dr. Ian Holzman. And it's funny because he's a professor of pediatrics and obstetrics and gynecology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And he almost says it as if that's a negative thing. And I say, hooray, that's right.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. So on that note, recently Health News, Kimmelin Hull published an article called The Top 5 Reasons to Avoid Labor Induction. So this is kind of interesting because, you know, this happens more and more. I notice with our practice members that they're really getting pushed into to having their labor induced if the doctor either feels the child is going to be too big or they've gone too far over their due date or for whatever reason. The number one is induction with Cytotec increases your risk of uterine rupture. Now, this is really interesting. It says this medication is FDA approved for treatments of stomach ulcers caused by certain medications.
That's weird.
That's what the FDA approved it for. It's not approved for use in pregnancy, including labor induction, as stated in the product package warnings, because there's a tenfold increase in the likelihood of uterine rupture when you use it to induce labor.
I thought they used Pertosin.
They use oxytocin.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
But I've heard of this Cytotec, and it says right here it's not approved because of uterine rupture. So that's something a mother should know. The second one is induction with synthetic oxytocin creates a more difficult, painful labor experience. So synthetic oxytocin, Mike, is called Pitocin.
Oh, it is. Okay.
So when your body naturally goes into labor, it releases oxytocin. So basically, Pitocin, it mimics it, but it's synthetic.
Right.
It's not real. And this goes on to say that when a woman goes into labor on her own, a gland in her brain, the pituitary, produces pulsations of the hormone oxytocin, which causes the uterus to intermittently contract. However, when her labor is induced with Pitocin, the woman is exposed to a constant flow of uterine-stimulating medication, causing the uterus to respond more irritably and persistently. So labor contractions, if they're under the influence of Pitocin, tend to be longer in duration, more intense in sensation, and closer together.
I've seen that.
So not only is it hard on the mom, but it says the baby suffers the effects of a uterus contracting down on him or her harder and more frequently.
I think it affected me too.
I've even heard of women that get induced and it doesn't even work.
That's true.
Yeah.
That happens sometimes. And so number three goes along with this. It says labor induction increases your likelihood of cesarean birth. Did you know that you can double your risk of ending up delivering your baby C-section if you're induced? Because it's just a cascade of medical intervention, because usually the intensity of labor is so strong because of the Pitocin that the mother ends up taking some type of pain relief medication. And they usually, because of that, the analgesia, like an epidural, because of that, they get restricted to bed. So then they can't do the healthy laboring things like walk around
snowballs.
And change position. So it just snowballs. And then the chance that the cervix won't dilate, or the baby gets distressed, or the labor won't commence fast enough because the mother can't move, it leads to C-section. So it's becoming well known that if you decide to induce, you're really setting yourself up for a much higher risk of ultimate C-section.
One thing I read in a book about due dates is that when you go to the doctor, they look at a wheel and give you your due date based on a 14-day cycle. So
a 28-day cycle, a 14-day...
14-day ovulation.
Ovulation, yes.
So these women who have irregular cycles, who are ovulating much later, are being induced because they're being told that they're late when they're in fact not.
That's true. I mean, all that date work is just a guess. The fourth one is that labor induction can lead to delivery of a preterm baby, because the baby's, the reason you haven't gone to labor is the baby's just not ready. And then the fifth one is labor induction robs the baby's chance of signaling when she or he is fully developed and ready for birth.
And that comes back to innate intelligence.
It does. And when the baby's fully mature, it will tell you it's ready to be born.
Right.
So having that trust. Here's a very short article. Now, this was published in healthnews.com, and it's just kind of a funny thing. Novel approach to pain, crossing your arms. Yeah, so this woman, Lynn Walbrecht, said, there's a new study that shows that something as basic as crossing your arms may help in reducing the amount of pain a person feels. And it just, because it somehow confuses the intersection of the brain's two maps, which our pain sensations are lessened because of that. So
that's
what it does with the brain pathways, if you cross your arms, it can lessen the pain. Now, it says, while this unusual physical maneuvering may not work for all instances of pain, it is a quick and easy way to stem the tide, certainly worth not only trying, but befitting further research into the way your brain reacts to painful stimuli. I would be curious to know if they did a study where they inflicted pain, if people are more apt to cross their arms subconsciously.
Do you want to try that on Mike?
Yeah, you're going to pinch me or something?
So we're going to finish up with a Chicago Family Health Examiner by the name of Jasmine Jaffarali, and she has an article that just came out called Killing Household Ants with Splenda.
Ooh.
Yes.
And people eat this stuff?
Yes. And basically she says, I'll never forget when I first read about Splenda. I jumped on the bandwagon as everyone else did. Then about 4 years ago, I read that you could use Splenda to kill household ants. So I dumped my bag of Splenda in the dirt. And she was so fascinated, she decided to do some research. And she basically found out a lot of what I've studied myself, that Splenda was discovered accidentally in a lab back in 1975.
That's
when they were trying to create a new insecticide.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh.
And interestingly, Whole Foods now and Trader Joe's will not sell Splenda or any product that contains sucralose, which is what Splenda is, because it doesn't fit within their code of ethics of selling real food. Interesting. So basically, Splenda is chlorinated sucrose. So really the issue of what chlorine does to our body is what's important here. And chlorine is toxic. You know, it's not found in any food or table salt, or even the manufacturer of Splenda will tell you it's fine.
That's something you put in your pool, right?
Right. Well, it's caused damage to human health so much that Greenpeace has launched a chlorine-free campaign to have a worldwide ban on chlorine. But this is what's most interesting to me, because I just find it fascinating, that it goes on to say that if you're a future mother, you can read about how baby boys being born with shortened male anatomy due to chlorine passed to them in the womb.
Everybody out of the pool.
Well, and this is all comes from an article, CBS CBS Interactive Business Network by Paul Rauber, Elemental Enemy, Environmental Hazards of Chlorinated Chemicals. And he goes on to confirm that chlorine can literally affect male anatomy. It can shrink the male anatomy.
It's not a good thing.
Yeah, and that's why policymakers finally are seriously considered banning chlorinated chemicals. It took that, figuring that out, to do it. But interesting. Sometimes you just never know what it's going to take. On that note, this has been fun. I hope you all keep up with the news with me, or just listen to For the Health of It, because we bring you the raw talk about full potential living. Be well, everybody.
You've been listening to some raw talk about full potential living, For the Health of It. For more information, go to spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call Dr. Jennifer at 603-673-5600. That's spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call 603-673-5600.